Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. My name is Jürgen Haken. I'm a faculty member in the International Relations Department here at the London School of Economics, and I'm also the director of the Soslihoff Southeast Asia Center. And this is the Southeast Asia Center that is organizing this particular event tonight. I'd like to warmly welcome you to this public lecture, which is the third and final one in our sort of little mini-series that we're doing on ASEAN this year, against the backdrop of what is 50 years of ASEAN, well worth celebrating, obviously. Some of you may have been to the other two, those focused on the role of Indonesia in ASEAN, and also on the various ways in which ASEAN countries have been able to coordinate policy in the WTO and at the UN. To round off the lecture series, we will tonight focus on us in the context of continuing major power rivalry and competition in the Indo-Pacific region. And over many years, as you will know, the argument has been that ASEAN has been quite successful, actually, in shaping regionalism, economic and security regionalism, in the East Asia-Pacific, with the support of the major powers. But more recently, perhaps, we are finding that ASEAN is no longer operating in the kind of benign environment that there used to be. And the great powers now clearly have their own ideas that they are pursuing with less reticence than used to be the case. And that has certain implications for ASEAN, not least in terms of ASEAN unity, but also challenges that are posed in relation to ASEAN centrality. Notwithstanding these challenges, however, ASEAN has, of course, retained some measure of influence on the behavior of regional states as a whole, and is seen, as I think we will hear in a minute, as the driver of particular security logics in Southeast Asia and the wider East Asia. Now, I'm absolutely delighted to say that we have with us here tonight one of America's leading scholars on Southeast Asia and ASEAN to discuss ASEAN's institutional logics and effects. Yeah. Professor Ali Isbar is a professor at the University of Delaware in the US. As you will know, she is the author of Renegotiating East and Southeast Asia, and has obviously edited also, rather recently, The Institutionalizing East Asia, Mapping and Configuring Regional Cooperation, with another, I think, edited volume forthcoming pretty soon, which is on contemporary Southeast Asia. So if you haven't yet read her, please do so. Yeah, it is fantastic stuff. Alice, it's a great pleasure to be able to welcome you to LSE. And really, I think we're all very fortunate to have you tonight for our final ASEAN lecture. Now, as the norm is, Alice will speak for about 40 to 45 minutes. After that, we will move into the Q&A. If you have a desperate urge to tweet, please feel free to do so. The hashtag is LSEASEAN. We will try and offer a podcast, if this is technically possible, afterwards for you to pick up on our website. But in the meantime now, may I please, if you haven't already done so, ask you to put your phones on silent, and Alice, may I please invite you to address our audience.
Well, first, let me thank Southeast Asia Center here, and especially Professor Jürgen Haken for inviting me. Professor Haken and I actually go way back. We first met as graduate students back in the day when they still had physical papers at conferences. in fact, that's where we met. No doubt, on this occasion of ASEAN's 50th anniversary, I think it offers an opportunity to reflect upon the organization, its contributions, as well as its challenges. And I think this opportunity, as you've heard, may be made all the more important by the fact that ASEAN's 50th also corresponds with considerable uncertainty about great power relations and great power engagements in Asia, most notably on the parts of the United States and China. I know you've already heard from, many of you at least may have already heard from two excellent scholars on ASEAN and its role on regional and global stages. What I'd like to do is cut into these discussions on ASEAN a little differently and to reflect upon what is the shape, for example, of regional order, where do institutions fit in terms of what we find today, and to offer some different and perhaps alternative ways to also think about what institutions do, right, and how they've contributed, again, to the very messy environment, I would argue, that Southeast Asian states find themselves in. And then finally, I'll return to this also question about the conditions under which ASEAN in particular has operated in East Asia and what recent great power developments may signify for that role. So let me begin with some context as to the title of the talk. Over the last decade, for those of us who have been following developments closely, I think we're aware that Asia's strategic tensions have renewed in force attention to geopolitics, themes of great power rivalry, and I think no doubt for Southeast Asian states, much is at stake as these different states navigate a changing regional order characterized by what are basically important structural changes in terms of the balance of power. They are dealing with an increasingly more capable, influential, and confident China. And the United States, which has long been the status quo power in the region, but whose world and regional commitments are also increasingly in question. No doubt as well, Southeast Asian states have witnessed heightened competitive pressures on more than one front. For many observers, these changes make institutions simply less relevant to the changes taking place. And at very least, these great power developments raise important questions about Asia's institutions, and perhaps ASEAN especially. You probably discussed at least some of these questions in past talks if you were attended them. And such questions include, for example, questions raised by the seeming inability of existing institutions to reverse the trend of intensified great power competition of recent years. Questions also include ASEAN's own intra-regional and intra-organizational challenges in coordinating what some think should be a more unified and stronger stance on such pressing issues as the South China Sea. Certainly, the South China Sea, plus a range of other transnational challenges, from the environment to labor migrations to disaster management, among others, additionally press ASEAN to rethink, I think, defining practices as, for example, the practice of consensus. Again, such challenges raise some important questions about ASEAN and existing frameworks that ASEAN has played an important role in constructing in the region. And at the same time, where my talk cuts in, is that our great power preoccupations can also miss, I think, much that's going on in East and Southeast Asia. And certainly the strategic picture in Asia, I would argue, is also more complex than recent discussions have tended to portray. Right? To offer some examples, on the one hand, large powers are most certainly contending for influence. Yet to look at East and Southeast Asia, we also find peculiar patterns. Peculiar patterns of agency and initiative continue to be exercised by the region's small and middle states, and collectively even through ASEAN as well, as a platform for these smaller states to engage larger powers. On the one hand, as much as we are preoccupied with the destabilizing and divisive effects of strategic competition, to look at East and Southeast Asia, we also find the ongoing pursuit of regional economic integration and frameworks, as well as the remarkable persistence of frameworks inclusive of different contending powers. On the one hand, for the talk of all the failings of institutions versus great power politics, it also remains difficult to talk about Asia's shifting strategic landscape without giving some attention to the region's institutions and the place that ASEAN and ASEAN frameworks have occupied in Southeast Asian strategies. On the one hand, as much as we fear a divided Asia, the reality of Asia is that relationships crisscross and network in all sorts of varied directions. In short, Asia's strategic context is messy, at times contrary, and certainly complicated. If we're to get a more complete and accurate strategic reading, then, I think, of the many things that are going on in terms of the region's politics and strategic politics, I think we have to take into account that complexity. And in particular, the ways that strategic, economic, and institutional dimensions also interplay and interact with one another. And in particular, I think we have to bring institutions then back into the discussion. Because ASEAN and its institutions, I would argue, have themselves played important roles in encouraging and institutionalizing that complexity. Okay? In fact, one of the more underappreciated effects of ASEAN institutions has been its furtherance of a multitude of issues, interdependence, and again, its engagement of multiple actors that lends the complicated situation that I think we find in Asia today. So let me turn to this question now, and I want to begin with a brief discussion in how we typically have conceptualized institutions, and then offer some alternative ways to think about ASEAN and its institutions, what they do, and with respect to the effects on their effects on Asia's changing strategic landscape and where states find themselves today. One of the more remarkable features of East Asia's post-Cold War order has been the emergence of various regional cooperative frameworks. They're geopolitically remarkable, I think, in more than one respect. Certainly, as many note, they are remarkable for the role played by smaller Southeast Asian states, especially through ASEAN. They have been additionally remarkable for the ways in which they've defined, I think, and very much shaped a diplomatic landscape in Asia. Yet how to explain and assess these frameworks and their effects have remained important points of division and debate amongst those of us who study the institution. And in fact, we can go so far as to say that these debates have defined the literature, even, on ASEAN. Some of the more defining conceptions of institutions focus on institutional effects at individual state levels. Institutions exist to serve particular state interests in response to either a collective action problem, for example, or as a means to get problematic states into line. Okay? Most commonly, we think of institutions as compliance and coordinating mechanisms. In such discussions, institutions are mechanisms of constraint, corralling states into uniform lines. And again, as many have discussed, this is an area that ASEAN has historically been challenged on, as its modus operandi has been to operate by consensus and in more voluntary, flexible terms. Though this is not to say that ASEAN doesn't have normative effects in terms of constraining states to behave in certain ways. Increasingly common, especially over the course of the last decade, as great power tensions have heightened, has also been a conceptualization of institutions as tools of leverage and competition. In the last decade, especially observers of the region, for example, note that different powers contending for influence have tried to pursue or promote new or revised arrangements of different memberships, either to diffuse the influence of rivals by shifting the balance of membership, for example, in their favor, or alternatively to exclude those they don't like. Okay? Thus, some recent discussions characterize regional frameworks as, quote, power instruments to counter, dilute, balance the influence of another state that dominates too much of maybe another framework. One example, often cited, for example, is Japan's working with other ASEAN states to successfully push, for example, to expand the East Asia Summit to counter the APT, in which China was seen as wielding too much influence. Similarly, China's and Japan's often reactive economic proposals to Southeast Asia and counter proposals to ASEAN are seen as each of them trying to woo ASEAN states to their supposed camp. Most recently, the United States, under President Obama, for example, Washington's attention to both ASEAN and the TPP under the rebalance to Asia policies were explicitly framed in such terms. And here I'm quoting Ben Rhodes, a deputy U.S. National Security Advisor, who makes it quite explicit in terms of what U.S. engagement was designed to do. We made an assessment early in the administration that the United States was underrepresented in and has underprioritized engagement in the Asia Pacific. We, in many ways, were not even at the table, and that was creating an opening for China to set the terms for the future of the region. Both of these conceptualizations, us institutions as coordinating mechanisms and institutions as tools of leverage or influence, have their utility. And both also capture, I think, important politics that are going on in the region. For example, thinking about institutions as coordinating and compliance mechanisms points to the challenges faced by ASEAN institutions and reveals especially the continued attachment of most states to non-interference norms and relatedly to practices of consensus. And the ways that these norms and practices limit what ASEAN and other ASEAN associate institutions can do on issues in which there may be a wide range of differences among states or in cases that might involve domestically sourced challenges. In the case of ASEAN, it's additionally the nationalist bounded norms and practices are also reinforced by an institutional culture that makes respect for national autonomy an important starting principle for ASEAN unity. Meanwhile, thinking about institutions as institutions of competition sheds light on other politics, and in particular on important strategic distrust, what some call trust deficits, that continues to define much of the region's politics, especially as regards China's uncertain relations with a variety of actors, large and small. This said, as I've suggested, institutions also have larger effects that can be dismissed by conceptualizations that focus on the individual state-level drivers and effects, and certainly more conventional conceptualizations of institutions, as I've just described, insufficiently capture the mix of different simultaneous and contrary developments that characterize Asia's strategic landscape. So what are some other ways to think about ASEAN and its institutions, given Asia's strategic complexity? I think two ways to think about ASEAN and its institutions begin at different starting points. One is that we can cut into the institutional question from a different set of actors. A second is to cut at it from a different level of analysis. We can look, for example, thinking about different sets of actors. Rather than thinking about it in terms of the great powers or the large powers, we can look at it from the vantage point of smaller powers, actors for which institutions have come to provide important platforms for major power diversification, for omni-enmeshment, quote, omni-balance. These are all terms, in fact, in terms of the literature, in terms of scholars trying to describe ASEAN strategies. So institutions have provided these small states important platforms for major power diversification, omni-enmeshment, complex engagement of multiple powers, status quo as well as rising powers, hedging, limited, soft balancing. These are all parts of the discussion in terms of Southeast Asian strategies, and institutions have played an important role in terms of engaging a variety of actors. A second way that we can also cut into rethinking institutions is to think about it from a more systemic level of analysis. And so we can view where institutions can be viewed and conceptualized in the ways that they may facilitate and condition, in fact, macro-historical changes that are taking place in Asia. Specifically, I'd like to consider institutions as transitioning mechanisms. Okay? And to be more specific, ASEAN institutions have played important roles in transitioning East Asia from what has long been a U.S.-centric order, to a post-U.S. Regional order, albeit one that remains ill-defined. So, in other words, one of the things I'm going to say is that institutions have played an important role in transitioning us to the current state that we're in, and that small powers, furthermore, have actually played active roles themselves in getting us to this point. There are three related ways that we might think of ASEAN institutions as transitioning mechanisms. And here I want to kind of think a little bit more historically, thinking about context in terms of when these institutions first emerged. So these institutions, as Professor Haka mentioned in his introduction, these are institutions that were created mostly in the 1990s, early 2000s, basically the first decade, 15 years of the after the Cold War. And so in three related ways, we can think of ASEAN institutions as transitioning mechanisms, moving us from one era to another. They have created, regularized, and expanded. One, they've created, regularized, and expanded important processes and frameworks beyond U.S. arrangements, right, of the Cold War. They have, two, regularized participation of actors beyond U.S. allies. And here it's worth noting that institutional engagements and institutional emergence and some of the more notable developments in ASEAN in particular have been, in fact, highly correlated with heightened concerns about U.S. commitments in Asia. And here I've pulled out one quote from the Singaporean diplomat, Bilahari Kosgei, who highlights how this kind of thinking about institutions actually persists even to today in terms of thinking about how it responds to this uncertain U.S. environment and uncertain U.S. policies. There's now consensus across the region that while the U.S. is still a very necessary condition for stability, it is no longer a sufficient condition. And the U.S. presence needs to be supplemented, not supplanted, by some new architecture to preserve stability for growth. In short, ASEAN institutions, especially at the time of their creations, have served to accommodate or bridge two changing great power realities, I would argue, in East Asia, namely the uncertainties associated with changing U.S. power and commitments, on the one hand, and on the other, the entrance of China, that was neither well integrated nor well institutionalized in existing arrangements until the 1990s. To appreciate these first two points, again, we have to remember that before the introduction of these post-Cold War ASEAN institutions, and with the exception of ASEAN in Southeast Asia, there were really no mechanisms for broad regional cooperation in Asia, apart from a system of U.S.-centric, mostly bilateral arrangements. Consequently, the introduction of regional institutions provided what some have called the, quote, missing link, the missing link in regional security in Asia. And more specifically, it provided important linkages between U.S.-centric arrangements and a new China-inclusive reality. And finally, we can also think about institutions in a third, more contentious way. And that is to think about how ASEAN institutions, in serving as transition mechanisms, have also provided platforms for actors and to offer actors important opportunities to project alternative security and integrative logics of exchange and cooperation and security that contrast and also compete in important ways and interact in important ways with the consequentialist and more confrontational logics of, for example, more conventional security arrangements. Military alliances in particular would be the classic contrast, where you kind of think about different contrasting logics, as I'll explain. The projection of these logics through ASEAN institutions have constituted an important exercise, then, in what one discussion recently called the, quote, reconstruction and reimagination of security and discourses. Viewed thusly, we can also think of institutions as not just transitioning mechanisms, but also then as processes. And here I've pulled out a quote from Muzaka in terms of thinking about rethinking how we might conceptualize institutions in projecting alternative logics. But institutions may also be thought of then as processes which seek to define, order, normalize, and stabilize particular meanings, principles, beliefs, ideas and norms about a particular issue area held by some actors and at the expense and marginalization of those held by others. Okay? So we can also think about these platforms as projecting alternative logics of security that have bearing on other actors as well as other interests. Okay? Each of these contributions in terms of thinking about ASEAN's role as a transitioning mechanism, right, engaging rising and status quo powers, providing platforms for alternative security logics. Each of these contributions is evident in East Asia today, I would argue. But I want to give greatest attention here to the question of logics, right? These alternative security logics that ASEAN institutions project, where they're, again, how they shape the strategic environment, and again, how they may be challenged at the current strategic moment. So let me talk about logics. Logics regard, ultimately, why we do what we do. Okay? They are the understood, stated, and constructed imperatives behind the kinds of relationships we pursue. Or put another way, logics regard questions of why and how we come together, and why and how we come together with whom we do. When looking at ASEAN institutions, we might also say that a few distinguishing logics tend to stand out. The logic of inclusive engagement. That it is important to include states of the region if we're to have a durable security. The logics of inclusive common development. That common economic development is an important foundation for security of individual states and for the region as a whole. The logic of cooperative security, the pursuit of security with adversaries as well as allies, that again involves diversified major power engagements, but is also about enmeshing and bringing in major powers, both historic partners and more questionable partners, into norms of, quote, acceptable conduct. Okay. The idea then that is that these institutions are projecting particular paths and alternative paths to security that would contrast with more conventional avenues and paths of security that we typically emphasize in terms of that alliances, for example, that involve more consequentialist and deterrence logics. As I said, both these things matter in terms of Asia, but my point here is that institutions also introduce into the scene alternative, competing, and interacting logics that have shaped the course of the strategic environment. Together, I think we can also sum up these logics in terms of a persistent, even if highly contested, right? A persistent, but even highly contested and challenged discourse of regional community. And one of the things, and this is a term that was very prominent in earlier discussions of ASEAN, but again has mostly fallen out in terms of recent discussions because of great power politics. But I bring it up here because underlying each of the most significant of the institutional arrangements is a reference to the imperatives of actually regional communities as a long-term security goal and as a basis of security. Whether we're talking about the ASEAN Regional Forum, the ASEAN Plus 3, the East Asia Summit, and even the ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting Plus, which is a newer arrangement that's commonly characterized and categorized as a different kind of arrangement in terms of its purposes and logics. As I've suggested, and as I'll elaborate, more conventional calculations also matter and intervene. But this imperative remains one of the more critical reasons for why ASEAN institutions look the way they do and why they include who they do. It's worth noting as well that viewed in such terms, these logics make institutions also more than simply fallbacks to U.S. institutions and alliances, but they also suggest more potential and more transformative dimensions. ASEAN logics also typically contrast, I think, with great power logics, whereby organizations and institutions are based on, for example, or centered around the large power's ability to provide. Such logics produce also some of the more distinctive features of Asia's post-Cold War institutions, at least to this point, right? And again, these things are being challenged, but these are some of the distinctive attributes of these institutions as we have seen them in Asia. Regionalism, less multilateralism, this cooperation along regional lines as opposed to simply multilateral lines. Again, the inclusive development, inclusive engagement on regional actors is imperative in terms of a more durable, long-standing security. Comprehensive development priorities underlie, right? Comprehensive agendas, cooperative agendas, developmental agendas underlie actually most of these institutional frameworks. They're consensus-driven. And they also project alternative hierarchies, what we know today, characterized today as ASEAN centrality. And as a way to think about this is to think about how these logics justify that role, right? By making security, for example, a function of something more than deterrence, but rather the imperatives of inclusive engagement or inclusive development, it denies, in fact, large powers any automatic standing. They may still have standing, but it denies them automatic standing based on their large capacities alone. Meanwhile, the identified link between inclusive engagement and regional security also opens the door for small to middle powers to play leading roles. Inclusive logics, for example, call for the ability to convene, the ability of an actor to convene Asia's diverse states, an ability and authority that, again, is less determined by size than by its relations with a variety of actors. And in fact, as many have elaborated, states in Southeast Asia have, at least for much of the first decade or two of the post-Cold War era, enjoyed particular convening power. They have been able to set the agenda, the pace of regional cooperation. They provide the normative consultative platforms. And they have also defined, in many ways, the parameters of membership. Or put another way, then, such security logics and imperatives, again, have helped justify and rationalize a pattern of ASEAN centrality. ASEAN-related institutions have introduced to the East Asian system, in short, alternative security logics that have organized and ordered the East Asian system in some distinctive ways. Less U.S.-centric, but still U.S.-influential. More China-inclusive, and also more small power regarding. Okay? Institutions have introduced important features worth noting. One, and I'll come back to these points as well, one, the pluralization of actors. Two, institutionalized voice for small and middle powers. Three, the formalization and institutionalization of regionalization processes. Okay, so we can think about regionalization certainly in informal terms, the networks and economic engagements that states would pursue. But ASEAN institutions also formalize these regionalization processes. And so another contribution here, then, is to think about ASEAN institutions as formalizing and institutionalizing important regionalization processes, economic connectivity and connections that are also taking place in the region. Indeed, for Southeast Asian states, then, the result is a mixed system, right? It is a mixed system of mixed logics, okay? Where U.S. arrangements sit alongside ASEAN arrangements, where more conventional deterrence logics sit alongside alternative, more inclusive security logics. And here I've just tried to put together some contrasts as a way to think about these different logics that coexist and interact within this regional environment. If we think, for example, using U.S. Cold War arrangements as kind of the model example, we can think about U.S.-centric security conceptions versus more region-centric security conceptions. Vertical and hierarchical are authority relations versus consultative and horizontal authority relations. Bilateral versus regional multilateral engagements. China exclusive arrangements versus China inclusive arrangements. Functionally exclusive arrangements that are exclusive to those materially capable, to those most materially capable to contribute, versus arrangements that are broadly inclusive in regional membership and participation. Great powers have pride of place in one set of arrangements, where small and middle powers have at very least equal standing in the other set of arrangements. Strategic deterrence versus strategic reassurance. Alliances and task-driven cooperation versus regionalism and developmental regional integration. So we can think about some important contrasts and mix of logics and security logics and arrangements that form an important basis, an important features of the current regional system that we find in Asia today. And it is this complex, multi-layered regional order that is defined by mixed institutions and mixed practices. Less, for example, simply the U.S. Cold War arrangements. It is this mixed system of mixed logics and mixed arrangements that provides the context and conditions for recent great power developments. As I've suggested, in world politics, where great powers tend to rule, ASEAN institutions and their relational logics and projected hierarchies in institutional practice are certainly not uncontested, certainly far from it. ASEAN institutions are, in fact, all the more challenged at times of great power flux, as states find themselves in today. Indeed, the last decade has seen important changes in the great power conditions on which ASEAN institutions were originally developed and in which they initially emerged. Briefly, some of the most important of those changes include: one, whereas much of the earlier period was characterized by, I would argue, a relatively stable balance of power, based more or less on U.S. predominance and U.S. orientations, today we see that relatively stable balance of power challenged by sharpened questions about U.S. staying power and sharpened questions about a more capable and influential and confident China that is today increasingly able and willing to step into the breach. Other great power changes are also worth noting. From a time when great powers were mostly content to play more passive roles within ASEAN frameworks, the last decade has seen from both China and the United States much more proactive initiative to redirect integrative patterns of the last three decades. We can talk about China, as we'll discuss, as I'll highlight further. We can talk about China and its initiatives like Belt and Road, projecting alternative integrative logics that project alternative conceptualizations of regions. We can think about the United States and its pursuit of various economic arrangements, most recently of the TPP under the Obama administration, as also projecting alternative logics that project a different conceptualization of what cooperation and potentially regions look like. Okay? So we can think about this in a number of different ways in terms of thinking about how these great power changes change and challenge ASEAN institutions that were created at a different geopolitical moment. Okay? So as I mentioned, with respect to the TPP, as well as the East Asia Summit, Washington's participation in both, right? Actually, Washington didn't create the two, but Washington's participation in both, his decision to join the East Asia Summit, his decision to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership, arguably changed what those arrangements were about. Right? With U.S. participation, the EAS, the East Asia Summit, became, for example, more strategically, as opposed to developmentally and economically oriented. With U.S. participation, the TPP became much more explicitly directed at redirecting patterns of regional integration away from what had become more China-centric integrative patterns. And even, as you can see from the quote from former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, even thinking about the TPP, an economic free trade agreement in very conventional military terms, that passing the TPP is as important to me as another aircraft carrier. Right? And so U.S. participation in both these frameworks arguably changes what those frameworks were about. We can also talk about how in U.S. participation in these arrangements reflects its belief that cooperation should be based on functional, mission-oriented terms as opposed to, for example, cooperation based on preset regions. Okay? And this is why, again, we can think about things like the TPP as instances of plurilateralism or possibly multilateralism as opposed to regionalism, which again contrasts then with the regional frameworks as manifested in ASEAN institutions. Okay? For China, too, it has become more proactive in its initiative, as most dramatically illustrated by its creation of the AIIB, and also, of course, its Belt and Road initiatives. Okay, the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, has the potential to be a game changer. TPP, when the United States was still in it, I would argue, was also potentially a game changer. Right. So Belt and Road offers a potential game changer. And in both these efforts, when we think about Belt and Road Initiative, this massive pan-regional set of initiatives, building a variety of linkages across Asia and beyond, in both these efforts, we find China offering not just previously unavailable material and policy options to regional states, but also conceptually what Xi Jinping in last month's Party Congress called the China alternative. As with U.S. participation in the East Asia Summit and the TPP, China's initiatives project very different integrative logics. In this case, the integrative logic is about the benefits of associating with China as a major funder and driver of East Asian development and integration. And that will project, then, a different conceptualization of which states take part, which states have pride of place, and ultimately what those frameworks look like. Such great power initiatives challenges regional security and ASEAN institutions. This new proactiveness, the new great power dynamics, challenge regional security and ASEAN institutions in more than one respect. For one, as evidenced by the last 10 years, it has served to intensify dynamics of great power competition. I don't think it's a coincidence, for example, that heightened engagements under the Obama administration alongside China's proactive initiatives actually created a more heightened sense of tension and challenge for ASEAN as an institution. For another, we can also think about great power, how this great power initiative challenges regional security and ASEAN institutionalism, in that their projection of different logics and imperatives for collaboration compete with the foundations on which these institutions have been built. And they also, as a consequence, potentially challenge then and make less central ASEAN's interests and place in terms of shaping that regional landscape. Okay. At the same time, these developments do not negate the integrative logics and patterns that ASEAN institutions have introduced. And this is where I want to spend my last remarks on. The institutional effects of the last two decades provide important context through which great power actions get translated. Again, recent discussions have tended to see these dynamics as zero sum. Either the competitive dynamics will prevail over the cooperative dynamics, or once upon a time, we thought maybe the cooperative dynamics might prevail over the competitive dynamics. But the point here is that we often think about these dynamics in zero sum terms. Okay? Yet as I began this discussion by saying, the reality suggests a complicated picture of mixed logics and mixed practices. Broadly speaking, that mix is expressed in at least two ways in the current context. One, it has conditioned and moderated in some important ways the effects of great power competition. And two, it has shaped some important ways how that great power competition is expressed. First, we can think about how great power developments have made more prominent conceptualizations that emphasize strategic use of institutions, as I mentioned. Right? As great powers use institutions and new initiatives to basically try to shift the leverage or influence in their favor. And as noted, we do see such drivers and logics in play. At the same time, the normative expectations of ASEAN regionalism also shape some of the ways that that competition is playing out. For example, large power competition is expressed in the form that includes the form of ASEAN-focused and Asia-focused developmental goals. And projects and outreach. While these competing integrative schemes do have the potential, as I've suggested, to reorder, reorganize key relationships and their hierarchies, the dynamics of connectivity and regional integration in Asia's political economy and regional economy are, as Rosemary Foote and John Ravenhill have argued, networked and made interdependent through supply chains in such a way that fragmentation is likely to also have broad and significant effects, not just for one's rivals, but for the larger political economy. And again, we can also think about the ASEAN institutions as also maintaining an ongoing integrative agenda in terms of an inclusive regional integrative agenda. Meanwhile, ASEAN's own practices and orientations also serve to diffuse some of the effects of great power competition. Not all of it, but they serve to diffuse some of the effects of great power competition. Large powers, for example, may prefer more exclusive arrangements that marginalize other actors or shift influence in their favor. But ASEAN states are also playing a somewhat different game, right? In that they remain themselves non-exclusive in their partners, in their large power engagements, while states participate and are receptive to specific, though not all, great power initiatives. They also continue to pursue similar initiatives with a variety of actors, and they continue to pursue also broadly inclusive regional agendas. Thus, U.S.-ASEAN frameworks are supplemented not just by Japan-ASEAN frameworks, an ally of the United States, but also by China-ASEAN frameworks in Southeast Asia. Similarly, the intensification of the more exclusive TPP framework with U.S. participation when the U.S. was still participating was also supplemented with a corresponding intensification of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. I don't think it's a coincidence in terms of the timing of these negotiations. Okay? Expanded strategic cooperation with U.S. and other U.S. allies is also not exclusive of new strategic engagements and diplomacy, confidence-building activities with China. ASEAN and all the key larger powers also continue to participate in larger regional frameworks like the East Asia Summit. And in these ways, the more divisive effects of such competitive drivers can be at least mitigated by some of these logics projected by ASEAN institutions and integrative logics. To conclude, then, we can think about Southeast Asia, as Southeast Asian states, as having facilitated and intensified a strategic complexity through platforms that have facilitated a China's integration, that has broadened a U.S.-centric Cold War order, bridged a U.S.-centric order one, again, that remains to be determined. They've also provided platforms from which to negotiate U.S. and China-associated uncertainties through the projection of alternative security imperatives and logics. And while those imperatives and logics have always been contested, the result, nevertheless, is that today we find a complex picture of mixed logics and mixed practices. ASEAN institutions and ASEAN's normative commitments have played important roles in producing complexity. And here let me highlight some of that complexity in terms of their institutional effects. We can think about their multiplication of actors that regularly engaged in the region, the high density of exchanges between peoples, economies, polities, and leaders of East Asia across multiple domains, security, economic, human, environmental, and political. The expansion of issues and concerns that constitute security and that define any one relationship or its agenda. In other words, we don't have single-issue relationships. We have multi-issue relationships so that not one issue won't necessarily hijack an entire relationship. Their pluralization of frameworks and platforms, inclusive, mixed, overlapping, okay, in their membership for both engagement and cooperation. Again, great powers and those competing for influence may prefer more exclusive arrangements. But what we find is not just that Southeast Asian states are pursuing arrangements and frameworks with a variety of actors, but in fact, these institutions overlap in their memberships, in their functions, and these things also then interact with one another to create the complexity that we find. Okay? We see the diffusion of power centers. We see an ongoing agenda of regional integration through which issues and domains become even more interdependent and intersected. And finally, we see again a mix of overlapping and connected institutional frameworks and integration agendas. All these contribute to the complexity that we find in East Asia today. ASEAN institutions are not the only contributors to these effects, I should underscore, but they have served to regularize them and institutionalize them as part of this strategic landscape. Economists and political scientists have tended to see the proliferation of institutions and actors as inefficient, irrational, redundant, and discordant. Okay? But developments in Asia, as I've also suggested, suggest that proliferation may also serve to mitigate some of the sharper edges of competition, okay? Making it, again, difficult to make decisions without affecting other realms. The mistake we make, again, is in conceptualizing these different simultaneous developments as either in zero-sum terms or as if actors are making exclusive choices in distinct domains, when, in fact, actors large and small are choosing multiple options at the same time. Okay? This said, great power developments do challenge ASEAN and its system of mixed practices and logics, that it has facilitated and created. As noted, ASEAN institutions have developed under distinct great power conditions, and those conditions have been changing. I'll conclude with two remarks about those changing great power conditions. On the United States, there's been much talk about the implications of U.S. foreign policy under President Trump and the threat of disengagement. And while there remains much that is unknown about U.S.-Asia policy, and as many note, we may very well see continuation of important U.S. commitments in certain realms. But whether that materializes or not, arguably the damage has also been done. Right? Because for many in East and Southeast Asia, President Trump's words and actions have dramatically also made clear the contingencies of U.S. commitments in Asia going forward. As for the implications for ASEAN institutions, we might also say on a somewhat more conditioned note that past developments suggest actually that U.S. inattention in and of itself does not actually threaten ASEAN institutions. Actually, if we look at the trajectory of the development of ASEAN institutions, as I started out by saying, they're actually highly correlated with times when the U.S. seems to be inattentive. Okay, so, but what is different, of course, at this moment in time is, of course, China. Okay? And this is an unprecedented time of Chinese initiative. To be sure, there are all sorts of China domestic and regional questions about China's capacity to meet the ambitiousness of its projects as Belt and Road. And for all the reasons already highlighted, Asia's strategic complexity is likely to complicate a major reordering, at least in the short and middle term, in Asia. But perhaps most of all, while China's initiatives provide compelling attractions to various states, how China chooses to engage other regional actors will also largely determine its success. And institutions here can provide important buffers to asymmetry should, of course, China choose to pursue that route, right? If, on the other, China chooses to prioritize other means, right, and choose, for example, not to be more sensitive to the concerns that have been projected by ASEAN states, then in all likelihood, we will see much greater challenges and tensions in terms of security in Asia, but also within ASEAN itself. Thank you.
Okay, I think we will draw this to a close now. Thank you very much for attending tonight's event. Thank you very much for coming. Alice, I think, has offered us a very refreshing, exciting, and careful analysis of ASEAN institutions and their impact, and we are your friends. Thank you very much.